So my sense is that we are still standing, but unfortunately the angle of decline at the moment is pretty steep. I think, and I've said this repeatedly, that we're in the last chance saloon if we're going to be able to pull the so-called iron out of the fire.
Hello again and welcome. I'm Peter Bruce and this is the third edition of Podcast on the Edge, my leap into spoken journalism or podcasts, in which I give into my great fear, which is that I don't really know what's going on. And then, worse, in public, I ask people who do know what's going on to answer some spectacularly stupid questions. Some would say it's a karma.
The wonderful thing about written journalism, be it investigative, descriptive, comment or critique, is that the reader can't see what's on the cutting floor or in the notebooks. There's no time for such niceties here. The conversation you're about to hear will be cleaned up briefly for the odd cough or poor phone line, but that's it. But stick with me, please. I have a lot of questions to ask a lot of people over the next few years, and I've always been amazed at how generous experts often are with their time. Today's guest is special. I haven't always been kind to him, but he in turn has always been kind to me, a real gentleman. I first met Martin Kingston, I think back in 1992, when he was an investment banker, or what they then called, I think, Martin, a merchant banker, for what was it Kleinwort Benson?
Morgan Grenfell, Peter.
Morgan Grenfell. A friend and I were trying to raise money to buy radio licenses in the new South Africa, and he very politely turned us down. But he and I ended up arriving back in South Africa at more or less the same time. I came back to edit newspapers. Martin came back to run N.M. Rothschild's South Africa business. And since then, he's become a part of a very small group of businessmen who can literally call into any level of government almost any time he needs to. It's now a long time since those heady days of the Mandela presidency, Martin, and then when almost anything seemed to be possible. Nowadays, almost nothing seems to be possible. But during lockdown, you and a group of business leaders set up Business for South Africa and did a truly enormous amount of work on figuring out how to get the economy back on track after COVID. It's still with us, but your work was on the table when the social partners hammered out a deal that President Cyril Ramaphosa then took to cabinet and announced as his reconstruction and recovery plan just before Tito Mboweni's mini-budget at the end of last month. So, Martin, we've just been downgraded again by two leading agencies, making our debts even more expensive to pay off. Can we get out of this hole? And if so, how do we do so?
Well, Peter, that's a long question to answer, in fact, that you posed. And I remember those heady days, and indeed I remember you visiting me in the Morgan Grenfell offices in the early 1990s, and none of us would have anticipated then the achievements that we've seen as a country, but also not only the highs but the lows as well, and I believe that we've experienced some very serious lows over the past 12 years or so. And I say that because I believe it's the backdrop really to this conversation, which is that when we found ourselves confronted by the pandemic, we were already in a recession. Yeah. Few people had anything other than a very conservative view of the economic outlook for the country. There were high levels of frustration, irritation and concern, not just, I have to say, amongst journalists and commentators, but I would have to say, many stakeholders, including in particular the business community. We had staved off a downgrade for some time, but of course then were downgraded at a sub-investment grade, and the cherry on the cake, although it was no cherry on the cake, of course, was the arrival of COVID-19 on our shore, yeah. Which has had a catastrophic impact, not just, I have to say, on the economy, but I would say on the social fabric of the country.
And so your response as a business leader was to hear President Ramaphosa call for call this an opportunity for renewal. I was amazed at how quickly both he and ministers pounced on COVID as an opportunity to completely reshape the economy, to bend it in ways that it had never been bent before. And you and other business organizations, you were at BRUSA, but you led and put in, I know you put in an enormous amount of time because some of it was happening around me, into a business response to COVID, which covered so much ground and made so many wise recommendations. It was, you were part of a bigger thing then. Business for a lockdown as it was, hurting as it was really working hard to try and look for a way out for the country.
Yeah, that is, of course, I believe, sort of backdrop to the reconstruction and recovery plan that I know we're going to talk about. When we knew that we were going to see the pandemic come to South Africa at the beginning of March, Business Unity South Africa decided that we needed to intervene proactively. We formed Business for South Africa, as you said, a virtual platform, not just for the member organizations of BUSA, but also the BBC and any other business that could make a contribution. And it coincided, it happened less than 2 weeks before lockdown. We actually counseled for a hard lockdown because we felt that it needed to give us the breathing space we required to prepare our defenses, both our health defenses and broadly the country more generally. And I'll talk about that if you want a little bit later on. But most importantly, what we did was that we were able to galvanize and mobilize an extraordinary level of patriotic support from the business community, large and small, domestic, international, established and emerging, to put their shoulders to the wheel on a pro bono basis in three areas. One was on the healthcare platform. That was led by Stavros Nicolaou. So all the PPE that was brought into the country in the early days was brought in by Business for South Africa, working particularly, but not only, with organizations like the Solidarity Fund. The second was the labor market platform led by Rob Lee, that worked on interventions such as UIF TERS, COVID UIF TERS, which, by the way, has paid out over 50 billion rand during the pandemic. So I think really important. And the third, as you've mentioned, was the economic intervention group that I led. And in that period of time, we managed to assemble some 250 people working on the economic plan, who designed a short, medium, and long-term strategy for the country, which we tabled, in fact, on the 2nd of July, to the president and the economic cluster of ministers, as well as the NEDLAC partners, setting out what we thought as business was necessary. And that came out of a conversation that we'd had with the president and his executive about the fact that it was not going to be possible to achieve what was required to avert a complete economic meltdown, if you like, if we didn't have all the social partners working together, and that business had a very serious contribution to make, but that it needed to be tangible outputs, that we needed to take the hard decisions that we had avoided in the past. We needed to prioritize, particularly in the context of a highly fiscally constrained environment. And I don't believe that we've minced our words. I think that we respected the authority and the role of government, but we were very clear about the steps that we believed as business needed to be taken if we were going to be able to change the trajectory of economic growth, or to economic growth in the short term, recognizing that we're in for a long and hard slog, whether we take the decisions or not. Even if we do, it's going to take us some 3 years to return to a pre-COVID level of real GDP and levels of employment. And that's a very optimistic outlook, assuming we take all the right decisions and we mobilize all the requisite resources.
I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa would have liked hearing from you that you thought that this plan needed to be, or the recovery needed to be, a joint effort between all the social partners. He's a compactor by nature. And I have, in preparation for talking to you, I've read some versions of the report that you put out. I know there's a very long version, which I haven't, but there was a sort of 40-pager or a 25-pager where you pretty clearly spelled out what you thought was required. And I'm going to quote it back at you. Not that I'm setting you up for any sort of recrimination or anything, but you'd call for immediate, rational, pragmatic choices that must guide our actions, and as a nation, we must acknowledge our constraints. It's therefore of paramount importance that we prioritize ruthlessly and deploy our resources so as to secure the greatest impact in the shortest time. And Martin, what I wanted to ask you was whether when you look at what has happened in the ensuing months, right, your report has been subsumed into other work or other meetings. I don't know how much, I don't think anybody did as much work as business did, quite frankly. I haven't seen it. Are you content that your work's been recognized? Do you see your work in the president's recovery plan?
Yeah, well, firstly, I need to emphasize that we don't need to have acknowledgement, but I think we do need to feel that as a country we're taking the right decision. And I'd like to take you on a little bit of a journey because, as I said, we presented this. It was the result of 3 months' work, a number of people, I would say subject matter experts applying their minds from a vast range of disciplines and capabilities in the business world. On the 2nd of July, we tabled that to not only the president, but social partners. I mentioned social partners because pretty much immediately after a NEDLAC special exco was called by government in the middle of March, we created what was called a rapid response task team at NEDLAC, which was meeting almost daily to intervene in a whole host of areas to try and combat the pandemic. And it's important because in my experience, I've never witnessed such a high level of engagement and collaboration between labor, government, civil society, and business as we've experienced over the past 6 months. And that created a degree of trust and I think mutual respect, which was important. But we were ahead of the curve in the design and development of an economic recovery strategy. That's what we called it, an accelerated economic recovery strategy. And it took an extensive amount of engagement with government and labor as well as community to incorporate very significant aspects of that into the NEDLAC Economic Recovery Action Plan. And the NEDLAC Economic Recovery Action Plan was tabled to the president on the 15th of September. So that gives you some sense of time. And we could recognize all of the business interventions that you've referred to in the NEDLAC Economic Recovery Action Plan with a caveat. The caveat was that we felt, and you quoted it to me, the need to ruthlessly prioritize, that we couldn't as a country have our cake and eat it. We'd need to make difficult choices. And what we found during the NEDLAC process, of course, was that a number of additional priorities were added by social partners to the list. And we respect that because our list is not necessarily the only or the best list, but it grew. In fact, it grew from our 15 interventions to 200 and then was pared back to about 40. The president on the 15th of September then took that to two processes. One was the ANC Lekgotla and the other was the cabinet Lekgotla. And what emerged a month later in the middle of October, and recovery plan that you have referred to, which was initially presented and positioned as a government proposition. Now, you'll be aware of the fact that subsequently there has been quite significant adjustment to that, and the president has characterized it as not only the work of social partners, but requiring the support of all social partners to be able to implement, and I'm sure that we'll talk about implementation, because Achilles' heel in this entire process. The Minister of Finance, when we got downgraded on Friday, has made the self-same references to the need for social partners to work together to try and correct the perceptions that have created the impetus towards further downgrades. So I'm leading you on this journey because even in the reconstruction and recovery plan, we can see the vast majority of our recommendations are featuring there, but they have been subsumed into a larger tapestry, if I can put it that way. And I believe, and we as business are of the view, that we now need to again pare back some of the areas of focus if, as a country, we're going to be able to, you know, pull ourselves out of the very dangerous, I would suggest, chasm not only that we risk falling into, but I would say we have started falling into already.
what? Just give me an example of what you mean. What in your view needs paring back?
Well, for example, we think that, and I would like to start from a slightly different vantage point. One of the biggest constraints that we have is, and the president has been absolutely clear about this, has been a state that has been denuded of competence, capability, and capacity over the past several years. That action, that erosion of capability continues, and the need to shore it up with resources from wherever they can be sourced, assuming that it's without conflict and they come with the requisite skills and experience. Now, the reality is that when you've got both limited fiscal maneuverability, and I think that we've got extremely limited fiscal maneuverability, coupled with a lack of skills within the state, then you need to decide where you're going to focus your energy. So we would say that in the context of SOEs, and you may come on to this in a moment, that we need to focus on those SOEs that are systemically important. They need to be restructured, recapitalized. They need to have appropriate competent and capable management, independent boards, limited political interference, if any, but appropriate oversight by the shareholder. And the balance of them need to be put into ICU, and then we need to decide in a separate process how to handle them, because they're a huge drain on the fiscus. We say that ESCOM cannot be restructured in the absence of an overhaul of the energy sector, the electricity supply industry, but located within the energy sector more broadly. Government cannot do it on its own. We are underestimating as a country the amount of skill and expertise that is required, not just domestically, but to be brought in internationally to achieve and fast track that. There's a reluctance, we believe, to acknowledge some of these issues. We had agreed a social compact on the ESCOM restructuring, if you like, before the middle of March. In other words, before we went into lockdown. That social compact is now agreed, but has yet to be signed, let alone implemented by the social partners. Now, if we've got major challenges of the sort that I have just talked about, then it means that we cannot cover every sector. We cannot deal with the waterfront. We're going to have to be much more specific about where we put our shoulder to the wheel. We agree with the concept of infrastructure-led growth, but it can't be every single infrastructure project. We've said repeatedly that any such infrastructure needs to be viable, credible, and indeed implementable. It's not a question of harnessing private sector capital. It's actually a question of harnessing private sector skills and experience to fast-track that. And indeed, in the case of infrastructure, we have established an extremely good rapport with the infrastructure office, led by Dr. Ramakopa. We're beginning to second people as business into that process. It takes time. I'm not sure that we have the luxury of time, because my own assessment is that the sword of Damocles is in truth hanging over our head currently.
So, Martin, one of the things we already know about the ANC, you've known the ANC for longer than anybody I know, really, is that it's incapable of making up its mind, finally, on one thing. It's incapable of prioritizing. How can it be helped to deal with the fact that it can't prioritize? It simply can't. You can't have five priorities. You can have one. That's the whole point of the word priority. How does it understand, how do we get it to understand that 50 projects isn't impressive? One good one done on time, done well, is impressive.
Peter, unfortunately, your frustration is shared and echoed not only by myself, but by the business community. We have repeatedly, and we will continue to exhort the leadership, not only of the ANC, but of the country, to appreciate that the more they dilute what limited resources we have, and I keep on emphasizing the resources are both human and financial capital, effectively here, the less progress we're going to achieve, the less credibility is going to be able to be maintained. In fact, I think that we are no longer given the benefit of the doubt. That's self-evident by the reports of the rating agencies that have come out at the end of last week. But we will persevere in making those observations. The second point I would make is that as business, we will only put our shoulder to the wheel in those areas where we think that we can make a real difference. We're not going to spread ourselves thinner than we can afford to, because actually then we undermine our own credibility. And thirdly, sooner or later, and I fear it will be sooner, the bank account is going to run dry. And then there are going to be some very direct and real challenges that need to be addressed when the government is no longer able to pay for everything as it wishes to do. That is at the end of the day where the rubber is going to hit the road, when they no longer have the luxury of being able to pay for everything. And I think we know that day has already effectively arrived, Peter.
But if you listen to the Minister of Finance, he poo-poos the fact that the rubber has hit the road. He says, no, it hasn't hit the road. If I can't borrow money from the World Bank, I can raise it here on our markets. They're nice and deep.
I'm not sure that that's what he said. We've participated very directly in discussions, not only with him, but with National Treasury, including before and after the most recently tabled medium-term budget policy statement. Frankly, the slides they put up are shocking, not because they're poor slides. They're actually very good slides, well presented, but because the facts that are set out there are stark, clear, and in my opinion, are incapable of being misunderstood. Now, if the executive chooses to misunderstand what the Minister of Finance is saying, which is, and I've been in several meetings where he's explained this to the Labour constituency, but not only the Labour constituency, and now it is, we only have so much money, we're going to have to live within our means, then I think that he doesn't believe, I don't think that he has a different view to yourself and myself on this, Peter.
Yeah. One of the things that's come out of the recovery plan, and I think about it a lot because it bothers me and I can't, and it sounds sort of disloyal, and the person running the show is someone for whom I have an enormous amount of respect, but it's the local content requirements, or the sort of, you know, bringing back manufacturing to South Africa, or what the ANC had been going on for years about beneficiating our minerals. And of course, we do beneficiate a lot of what we produce here. We burn our coal. We have used the iron ore that we can produce in South Africa to make steel up until ArcelorMittal became, you know, basically defunct in South Africa and still can't manage to do its job properly. But what's happening with the localization is that it's triggered a rash of quite spectacular import duties and export duties, which are making it very difficult for people downstream to get hold of product. I was told the other day, and I live, you know, in a little village in the Western Cape, that no, I can't replace some corrugated sheets on my roof because they're none available in South Africa. They're none available because the distributors can't pay the price of the Chinese coil that gets imported into South Africa because the duties are now too high. And AMSA, which is ArcelorMittal, formerly ISCOR, can't supply the market. They're behind the curve. And it's just, and people are going out of business. And I wonder whether, you know, I read what you said in your report about localization. And if I have to, it sounded to me that it was the part of your plan that you were least convinced about. And I'd like to hear what you think about localization and what difference it can make to you.
So what we established during the pandemic, and of course, where, you know, it is still current, but not the same level of lockdown, when we reduced economic activity as aggressively as we did as a country, was our inability to survive without importing goods, and our borders were closed. So we were throttling our economy effectively before we even get to the subject of import taxes and duties. What equally became apparent was that there, and it's not new, was that there is scope to increase the level of local manufacturing of particular goods and products with the proviso, and we've been very clear about this as business, so you're correct to have identified it within our report, that it is both viable and practical to implement localization projects, which can only be done not only on a sector, but on a product-by-product basis. Now, to achieve that, one needs to have a high level of cooperation and collaboration, not just between industry players, mindful of competition or antitrust considerations, but also working with the state, in particular the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, to ensure that if there are punitive duties or structural defects that prevent us from achieving those objectives, they're resolved. The Minister of Trade and Industry is extremely passionate about this. He's spoken very publicly on the subject, as indeed has the President. And we have committed as business to try and set realistic targets across a swathe of sectors, but with the proviso, and I need to emphasize that, with the proviso that it is viable and practical. And that's a very significant proviso. So when we talk about the agro-processing sector, poultry or sugar or edible oils or grains, or when we talk about the pharmaceutical sector or indeed the health sector where we've started manufacturing PPE and even indeed ventilators or basic consumer goods, in the final analysis, Peter, it's about the sort of micro product, if you like. It's not clothing generally. It's a specific type of clothing or footwear or home textiles. It's about what type of stoves or fridges or consumer electronics can indeed be produced in South Africa, or large-scale mining equipment or construction chains. Now, that's a huge amount of work. We need to manage everybody's expectations as to what can realistically be achieved in the time frame concerned, mindful of, I think, three particular aspects, and you've touched on one already. One is that in some of these areas, we just don't have the inputs, and we need, even for semi-fabricated goods, we need to import some of those inputs. So we need to get our mind around that. The second is we don't necessarily have the requisite skills. I mean, there has been, again, an erosion of the requisite skills. We've got to rebuild skills and capability. And the third, and I believe that this is a critical one which we must ignore at our peril, is that we can't expect the financial sector to advance credit or to invest equity in propositions which don't meet their criteria in terms of risk-adjusted returns, which, by the way, is not accepted universally by all of our social partners. But as far as we're concerned, you know, is a line in the sand, not that we won't, but that we can't transgress. And we're not going to do anything that's going to undermine the integrity of our financial system. So when you put those three sets of constraints around it, it actually narrows the opportunity set. But it doesn't mean that there aren't many opportunities to be pursued. It's just going to take longer and be more than we previously
perhaps it's just the metals business. You know, I've got emails that I see from companies to their business association from small businesses. This is not, you know, this is not Score Metals or Max Steel, which is already in court with the Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition over import duties. But here's one. We currently have raw material to sustain us for the upcoming week, maybe. And we have been advised that the required raw material will only be rolled mid-November, but this is not a guarantee. Another one says, we're unable to complete equipment production in time, and in some cases we've had to redesign equipment to suit the available steel sheet thickness. This is affecting our credibility with overseas clients. Due to AMSA steel shortages, we are unable to find any channels or IPEs. An IPE is a joist, basically, a steel joist. This is causing huge delays in our production. This is all in the last week. They're unable to tell us when stock will be made available again. In spite of those things, right, now AMSA is, you know, AMSA at one stage was on the government's bad list. In fact, Rob Davies, as a minister at the DTI at the time, excluded steel from AMSA from AMSA being used in any government projects. Then a deal was done and it was brought back into the fold. But basically, what we're doing and what business is kind of getting drawn into here with this localization, particularly with metals, is we're going to do what we did with Eskom. We are going to raise prices in order in South Africa in order to protect what is effectively a monopoly. That's surely crazy.
Well, I agree with you, and we've said that. And by the way, it's not just localization this applies to. It's any other form of, let's characterize it as a structural engineering of the economy, which doesn't withstand scrutiny as being viable and implementable. So I would say the same thing applies to BEE. We absolutely and passionately believe that we need to see a transformation of the economy, of the ownership of the economy, but we need to do it in a manner that actually doesn't impose an additional tax on an economy that cannot afford it at this moment in time. So we are not going to support, as business, and I don't believe the country can afford to do so, any interventions, including with respect to localization, which are punitive in the short and the medium term. We can, of course, have an ideological discussion about whether or not in the longer term. We can't get through to the longer term, Peter. We just don't have the runway to do that. We need to be extremely focused on where we can actually improve economic output, productivity. We need to, and by the way, our competitiveness, our ease of doing business, all of the issues that you have focused on have been areas that you know we have emphasized in our own economic recovery strategy, which is unless we can as a country profile ourselves as being a much more competitive investment destination, I mean, by the way, for local business as well as for international businesses, where we improve the ease of doing business, in particular, by the way, not for large companies, but for small and medium-sized enterprises, and any conventional economy would be the backbone of economic activity, including the payment of direct and indirect taxes and the creation of sustainable employment, then we are to find ourselves in a much more dangerous set of circumstances than we are in already. So we have, I think...
I'm holding a report now done for the European Union office in South Africa, which says local content requirements can lead to economic isolation, with activity concentrating in sectors where local content requirements are imposed, potentially undermining industrial diversification and long-term economic growth. It's not making us very popular with people who we buy things from. And I wonder whether we have the markets to sustain the kinds of things that we might want to, that we think we want to make. You know, if localizing the production of X or Y product was going to be profitable, well, why is it not being done already? Why are we going to force round pegs into square holes? I understand the need. I understand the desire to see, you know, smoke coming out of South African industrial chimneys again, and it's nice and romantic. But, you know, I worry that we've been taken back to sort of, you know, British Labour government policies of the 1960s, you know, where ultimately you're forced into not only imposing duties, but in order to dampen the price increases that you then let loose in the country, you start imposing price controls on products like sugar or steel, which is the road to hell.
So I fully agree with you, and an interventionist approach of the nature that you're talking about is going to be completely and totally counterproductive and will undermine any prospects that we have. And we have emphasized repeatedly to the government, and it's not just the government, because I have to say that their alliance partners in the form of Labour have very similar outlooks, which is we can't reduce the workforce, we can't introduce the concept of productivity. We have no choice but to improve productivity. You'll have seen the BUSA work that was commissioned recently on public sector wages and our comparative advantage or disadvantage on a global basis. It frankly makes for very concerning reading. I think we have established a quality of dialogue with government, in particular, but not only the economic cluster, about what is required to be able to mobilize the capital concern. The capital comes from the private sector. The capital doesn't come from the public sector, and one cannot force that particular capital to travel unless there's an appropriate investment environment. I think we understand that. You certainly do, Peter. Whether everybody in government does remains to be seen. But one cannot oblige, you know, one cannot prescribe private sector investment any more, I think, that we're going to end up prescribing assets, which I know has been much talked about by the ANC. I think we would be on a hiding to nothing domestically and internationally if we were to go down that route. And the reality is that we're going to have to be able to access capital domestically, mobilize it domestically and indeed internationally. And when you talk about the Minister of Finance having no concerns about tapping the local market, that may be so. I haven't heard him say that myself. But what is for sure is that the cost is going to increase and the depth of that capital market is going to shrink if we don't actually make sure that we pivot the economy onto a much more aggressive trajectory, of course, of inclusive growth, but one that doesn't have these types of strictures imposed upon it.
Martin, just two very quick things before I let you go. To what extent is the Department of Home Affairs a barrier or a springboard to faster economic growth? You know, we talk about skills and the lack of them and what a difference skills could make to the way, to the speed with which we can get things done. Because often people decide on something and then look at it and say, well, how on earth do we build a dam, you know, on the Umzumvubu River now that we've gazetted it? Or whatever road or whatever project there might be. Surely there's merit in considering at least a program to encourage people to come in and live here. And this with the proviso that, you know, you can come, you can get South African citizenship, whatever it might be. All you have to do is come here and in 3 years create 5 jobs. You know, this is a pretty decent place to live compared to some parts of the world. And I just wonder whether that would be attractive or useful or even politically possible.
So one of the low-hanging fruits that we were talking about previously was specialist skill visas. That's exactly in the zone that we were talking about. There's absolutely no doubt that we have to import skilled people from abroad who can ramp up or shore up those areas where we don't have the capacity within the country. We've tabled it repeatedly to the president. We've been assured of the fact the specialist skill visas are going to be fast-tracked. There is, by the way, movement taking place there, perhaps not as fast as I don't believe that the Ministry of Home Affairs is an obstacle anymore. I think it was historically. But unfortunately, when we've had an engine that's been idle for some time, it's going to take longer than we would like to get it moving again. But you're absolutely correct. We need to, wherever possible, bring in. And by the way, it's not just engineering skills. It might be teaching and educational skills and disciplines.
Project management.
Absolutely so. Absolutely so.
And then lastly, both business, everybody does this. Everybody talks about inclusive growth without ever having sort of bothering to explain what it means. And I think to most people, it's a kind of, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats kinds of thing. So if we've got economic growth, everybody, it affects everybody positively. But is there any discussion ever that you're part of that you can talk about? Whether, you know, does anybody look at real inclusion, measurable inclusion, where, as the Germans were forced to do after the war by the Allies, where the unions and business were forced to cooperate with each other, in what they call Mitbestimmung, so unions now sit on German supervisory boards and know what directors know at the same time. What it does is to rob or to remove from the air all the toxins that we face in South Africa, where rumor becomes fact and this company is going to sack the 1,000 people when it's not true. Why do we not move the inclusion conversation to something higher and more tangible? You know, the Germans, with all of that, they're still the most competitive, I think certainly one of the top three most competitive industrial economies in the world. And they've just recently or about to bring into law a stipulation that at least one third of all boards of all companies have to be women.
So actually, you must be a crystal ball gazer, because that conversation is now taking place, Peter, not just in terms of board representation. That's obviously a very complex issue. We need to make sure not just that we navigate through the corporate governance aspects, but we mitigate any conflict. But unless and until we have the clarity, the transparency, the broader accountability that you're talking about, levels of mistrust will continue to undermine our ability to make progress. And we need to have an appropriate compact between business and labor, and we understand that. But that requires both sides, and I would have to say government as a regulator, to acknowledge that what was, you know, appropriate in the past, if it was, is not fit for purpose for the future. So, for example, when I mention productivity, when I talk about wage restraint doesn't just apply to the public sector, it applies to the private sector as well. We cannot be having a conversation about SABC when it doesn't have the financial wherewithal without recognizing it's going to have to trim its costs. There is no ability to recapitalize SABC, and if there was, there shouldn't be, because there are more deserving cases. That means that they need to live within their means. It doesn't necessarily mean that they need to retrench their workforce. It may mean they need to pay their existing workforce less. We cannot have a situation where the unions are threatening to go on strike because they want a pay increase when there is not the financial wherewithal to support that. But by the same token, business needs to be, I think, much more open-minded, exactly as you have suggested, about a form of cooperation and collaboration, indeed with organized labor, because that's the only way that we're going to achieve the inclusive growth that we all aspire to. Inclusive growth, which, by the way, is going to take much longer to become a reality than we would like. And I suppose the final point I would make, and again, you touched on this at the beginning of your question or your comment, is we need to be able to measure this. There need to be measurable outcomes, and we need to hold people to account accordingly. I believe as a country we fail on both counts, but it's actually not beyond the wit of man to put in procedures that enable us to do both.
Martin, very last question. Are we still standing? Do we get through this?
So my sense is that we are still standing, but unfortunately the angle of decline at the moment is pretty steep. I think, and I've said this repeatedly, that we're in the last chance saloon if we're going to be able to pull the so-called iron out of the fire. To do that, we're going to have to work collaboratively, and we're going to have to work urgently. And as you indicated previously, we're going to have to prioritize. We're going to have to decide which choices we're going to have to make, and we're going to have to motivate why we've done that, rather than wanting as a country to have our cake and eat it. If we manage to round that corner, then I'm pretty confident. If not, then I believe that the outlook for the next few years is going to be very bleak and is going to undermine the stability of society. Well, we can't afford to go down that route. So we have to focus on the former approach, Peter.
Martin Kingston, thank you so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate talking to you. You've got such wisdom, such insight. It's a privilege to have had you. Many thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Peter. Very nice to speak to you.
Thank you very much for joining me once again, and I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Martin Kingston. This podcast is available on all your podcast platforms, on Apple, Google, Spotify, Iona FM, Pocket Cast. I don't really even know what all of those are, but I know that I am really enjoying talking to people and in the knowledge, hopefully, that you are listening or going to listen to what we've had to say. I'm trying to pick interesting people. I'm trying to focus on the things that I'm not confident to talk about, so that I learn as I go along. Please join me every week while I do this. There's no end to the amount of people I want to talk to, and there's no end to the amount of information and entertainment I want to bring to you. Thank you for joining me. See you next week.